looked for the wooden crate together, and Val watched as Archie cut a door in the front and nailed planks together to make a roof, over which he pinned sacking to provide protection against rain. Then they moved the crate into position near the kitchen door, the best place for a dog to be, Archie said, so that he doesn't feel left out. She had been putting off the moment when she would tell him where the dog came from, but now, with Peter Woodhouse introduced to his kennel, and already lying down on the sacking bedding inside, the long run from the village had caught up with him, she broached the subject.
"My cousin Willie gave him to me," said Val. "He took him from his last owner. He beat him."
Archie was not paying much attention. "Oh, yes," he said vaguely. "He was one of Ted Butter's dogs." This brought a reaction.
"He belonged to Ted Butter's, over at Craig Hill?"
Val nodded.
"Willie works over there. He says he treats his dogs terribly, beats them. That's why he took this one away from him."
For a while, Archie was silent. Then he asked, "Does Butters know?"
"No, he doesn't."
Archie stroked his jaw.
"There's no need for him to know," he muttered. "Can't stand people who treat dogs badly. Never could."
Val felt relieved.
"He'll assume he strayed. Dogs do that."
Archie agreed.
"Keep it to yourself," he said. "If nobody knows, Butters won't ever find out. That man, disgrace to farming he is."
Val knew then that she had an ally, and Peter Woodhouse, who had been at the mercy of a bully and a tyrant, now had two allies too. It was like the war, she thought. Small countries who had been bullied had discovered there were big friends willing to fight for them. It was enough to make anybody believe that there was such a thing as justice, somewhere in the inner workings of the world, in the mechanisms of human affairs, there was justice. The dog settled in quickly. At lunchtime on that first day, Val left her work cleaning out the henhouses to check up on him in the yard. He greeted her effusively, and she untied him to let him explore his new surroundings. Archie called her in for lunch. He had heated a pot of leek soup. And from the kitchen window, they both watched Peter Woodhouse running around the farmyard, sniffing at everything and getting to know his new home.
"I've got some stew for him," said Archie. "I'll call him in."
He went to the door and shouted the dog's name. Peter Woodhouse hesitated, uncertain what to do. A call in the past might have been the prelude to a beating, but he sensed now that things were different, and he came trotting over to the kitchen door. Rewarded with a large bowl of stew, which he wolfed down with all the urgency with which dogs attack their meals, he was allowed to join them in the kitchen. There he wasted no time in finding a spot near the wood-fired cooking range, stretched himself out, and was soon half asleep. One eye remained fractionally open, though, in the way that dogs will have it when they are keen to keep at least some sort of watch on what is happening around them. "The thing to remember," reflected Archie, "is that these creatures are pack animals. Understand that, and you understand a dog."
"They need a leader," said Val.
"Yes, they need a leader. And that's why they put up with people who are unworthy of them, like that Ted Butters. He's the man in charge, you see, and they just accept it. You never get dogs arguing about that sort of thing. Even dogs over in them communist countries, they don't go around having revolutions and whatnot."
Val laughed.
She had begun to see a dimension of Archie that she had been unaware of at the beginning, when she'd first started working on his farm. He was just a farmer then, a taciturn, middle-aged man who liked things done in a particular way, and seemed to be content enough with his own company. But slowly he had revealed his sense of humour and his kindness, and she was heartened by both. Chapter 6 Mike said, "I guess you're my girl now." He blushed. "I find it kind of hard to say these things, but you know what I mean." They were sitting in a pub in the village. There were few people there, a couple of the girls from the land girl house waiting for some young men from the RAF base, two farmhands still in working clothes, their trousers tied with binding twine just above the ankles, a lonely-looking man in a sports jacket and tie reading the racing page of the paper. Val and Mike were far enough away from anybody to be able to talk without lowering their voices, and to hold hands without attracting attention. She looked down at the floor and then up again to meet his gaze. She liked to see him blushing. It was a curious, boyish thing, almost a matter of manners. "I'm happy with that," she said. "I like being your girl." He squeezed her hand. "When all this is over," she sighed. "We say that all the time, don't we? When this is over. But somehow I wonder whether it ever will be, or whether it will just go on, and we'll..." He interrupted her. "It'll be over. And then I'll take you back to the States with me. Would you like that?" She felt her heart beating. Willie had asked her that morning whether Mike had proposed to her yet. He had said, "He'll want you to marry him, I bet. Any time now he'll ask you." She had told him not to be ridiculous, but his words had thrilled her. Of course she'd thought about it. Any girl going out with a man at least thought about the possibility, unless, of course, she was purely out for a good time, for tinned peaches, as her aunt would say. And there were girls like that, girls who were out to get what they could without any thought as to the man's feelings. Now he was talking about her going to America, and how could that be seen as anything but a proposal? "What would I do in America?" she asked. She knew that she sounded teasing. She did not intend it, but she did. He hesitated for a few moments before answering. "I'd look after you." "We'd go to Muncie, Indiana." He squeezed her hand again. "Anywhere you want. We could go out west if you liked. Los Angeles, maybe. I could get a job there, now that I have this experience of aerial photography." She wished that he would ask her directly. Why could he not just say, "Will you marry me?" She would say yes to that question. It was what she wanted. "I wouldn't mind going to America," she said. He leaned over towards her and planted a gentle kiss on her cheek. One of the land girls, still waiting for their RAF boyfriends, noticed and flashed a smile of encouragement. "Then we're engaged," he said. It was not a question. It was a statement of fact, and she nodded her assent. She did not say anything, although she tried. It was too difficult for her because she found herself not thinking of him or even of herself, but of her mother and of how she would have approved of him. She had approved of everything her daughter did right from the beginning. She had never thought her daughter anything less than wonderful. She realized that he had said something about a ring. "I'm sorry, I was thinking." It seemed as if he understood. "Of course. It's a big thing, isn't it? Getting engaged, and then getting married." "Getting married?" She closed her eyes. He said, "There's a guy at the base can get hold of rings from the States. He knows somebody in the business. He can order them." "That would be lovely." It was all she could think of to say. "I need to know the size of your finger. He has a card, this guy, and you put your finger into the hole that fits. Then you know the right size." She laughed at the thought. "You Americans think of everything, don't you?" But now a shadow passed over her face, and he saw it. He asked gently if something was wrong. "You don't have to say yes, you know. The last thing I'd want to do is to make you say yes. You know that, don't you?" She reassured him that she had said yes freely, and that she meant it. She did not reveal to him, though, what her thoughts had been, because they had been of the path of danger into which he flew every day, or almost every day. She had seen a plane limping home, a trail of smoke, not wide but visible, issuing from an engine. Even if they were just taking photographs, they were flying over the heads of people who would be trying to bring them down, and who, from time to time, probably rather often, succeeded in doing so. There were legions of young women who had become engaged to men who were risking their lives in this way and had learned that the game of dice their menfolk played had gone against them. One of the land girls on another farm was in this position. Val had seen her, and she had been tearful. One of the other girls had whispered the explanation. Her fiancé of 2 weeks had been shot down somewhere, and now she had been notified officially that he was dead. "I don't want to lose you," she said. He laughed. "Nobody's going to take me away from you. Nobody." And then, with an expression of mock bravado, "Let them try." It suddenly occurred to her that there were young women on the other side thinking the same thing about their men, and their men would be saying the same words back to them. It was the men who started it, she thought. Left to women, it would not work out this way. They would ground the planes that took their lovers from them. They and the mothers would put a stop to war. That was a thought that Annie had often expressed, but no sooner had she done so than she had admitted that men were needed to fight evil.
"Hitler wouldn't listen to us women," she said. "There's only one thing that Hitler understands."
Mike was looking at his watch. She did not dare ask him whether there was a mission that day. She assumed there was.
"I have to get back to the base," he said. He looked at her. "I'll be thinking of you tonight. I have to go out with a bomber tonight. They're short of men."
Her heart gave a leap. Not all bombers came back. Everyone knew that. They were lumbering and defenseless, people said, and the men who flew them simply had to grit their teeth, do their job, and hope that they dodged the flak thrown up at them.
"You must be really careful."
"Yes, of course I will. In and out. Back to base."
"And I'll be thinking of you, too. Always. All the time."
He put his fingers to her lips.
"Promise?"
She moved his fingers gently and placed them where she imagined her heart was.
"Promise."
Chapter 7
"I ain't going back," said Willie. "I don't care if they shoot me. I ain't going back there."
Annie attempted to calm him. She had seen how he could get worked up, and she knew it could end with him in tears, sobbing his heart out over something that any normal young man would treat as minor.
"Hush, Willie, hush. Nobody's going to shoot you."
She glanced at Val, who rolled her eyes.
"They don't shoot people who leave their jobs," said Val.
Willie stared at him, his bottom lip quivering.
"This is wartime. It's different in wartime. They can shoot you if you disobey."
"That's in the army," said Val, "and only if you run away from the enemy."
"And not any longer," added Annie. "That was in the First War, at the Somme and places like that. The army's more civilized now. They don't shoot their own men."
She was not sure about that. She thought they probably did, but she was not going to give Willie yet another thing to worry about.
Willie looked unconvinced. "Anyway, I don't care. They can't make me go back to Ted Butter's place."
They were standing in the kitchen. Willie had just returned from work early. Usually he arrived half an hour or so after Val, but he had come in before that, his hair disheveled and his expression agitated. Now Annie suggested they all sit down at the kitchen table, and Willie could tell them exactly what had happened.
"So just calm down," said Annie. "Calm down and tell us what went wrong, from the beginning."
"I went to work on his farm," said Willie. "I started 4 months ago. He told me..."
Annie reached out to put her hand on his arm.
"No, Willie, not that beginning. From today, this morning. What happened today that made you come back early?"
"It was the rats," said Willie. "Them rats in his haystack. They made a big nest, like they always do. Pa rat, ma rat, and all their nippers."
"Kittens," supplied Val. "They call the little rats kittens. They have litters, same as cats do."
"I knew they were there," Willie continued. "They weren't doing any harm. You didn't have to kill them."
Annie sighed.
"Farmers do, Willie. They kill rats because they eat food that's meant for livestock. And if the farmer grows grain, too, oats and barley and so on, rats love that for their tea." "Auntie's right," said Val. "Archie lays poison for rats. He says they steal his eggs, and they do. I've seen eggs broken by rats. You can see the tooth marks."
"These rats were doing none of that," persisted Willie. "They were minding their own business. They weren't in the barn."
He paused. "And I wanted to take one of them. A rat can be a friendly creature. Same as a small dog, they say."
This brought a response from Annie.
"I'm not having rats around here," she warned. "Not for anything. Nasty creatures, with those long tails of theirs and their teeth."
Willie ignored this.
"He hit them with a shovel," he said. "All of them. The old family."
Annie exchanged a concerned glance with Val.
"You didn't?" he cut her short. "I didn't hit him, if that's what you're worried about, but I told him what I thought of him."
Annie breathed a sigh of relief.
"Well, he probably knew that already."
Willie smiled. There was a sly satisfaction in his look.
He didn't like it, he didn't. I told him that he didn't deserve to have any animals. I told him that his dog hadn't run away, I'd taken him. He didn't like that, neither.
Val frowned. You told him you'd taken Peter Woodhouse. Did you tell him where he is, Willie? Willie did not seem to appreciate the gravity of the situation.
I told him he had a much better home over at Archie Wilkinson's place.
Val suppressed a cry of dismay.
Oh, Willie! He didn't like that, crowed Willie. You should have seen his face. He went all purple. Ted Butters gets purple when he gets cross, he sniffed. He said I should go, not bother to come back. I told him I didn't want to come back, but what about the money he owed me? A full week's wages. He said I could do what I liked, but he'd never pay me. He said if I didn't clear off, he'd fetch his shotgun.
Annie glanced again at Val and shook her head slightly. You can't be blamed, Willie. You should never have been sent to that man in the first place. You're well away from him. He seemed reassured.
They'll find me some other place.
Of course they will, said Annie. There are plenty of farms needing somebody.
And the army won't take me.
No, the army won't take you. They told you that, remember? They said you were better working on a farm. She paused, once more glancing conspiratorially at Val. You know what I reckon, Willie? I think that if they told Mr. Churchill himself about the work you do on the land, he'd say, well done, William Burks. That's what he'd say, Willie. Mr. Churchill himself. He rubbed his hands together with pleasure.
It's what I do best. It's what I do best to help win the war.
Annie was soothing. Of course it is, Willie. And now, why don't you go and have a bath before I serve your tea? There's a clean shirt in your cupboard. I ironed it this morning. You put that on. Once Willie had left the kitchen, Val shook her head in disbelief.
I can't believe he doesn't understand. It's so basic. He told Ted Butters to his face where Peter Woodhouse is. Now what?
Annie sighed. You tell Archie tomorrow that he has to find somewhere safe for the dog. There'll be plenty of time. Ted Butters won't do anything this evening, so put the dog someplace where he'll not be found. Let the whole thing blow over.
What if it doesn't?
It will. It'll blow over. Ted Butters is too busy with his black market activities to spend time making a fuss over a dog.
Black market?
He sells chickens. Sometimes a pig. He sells to that Martin Crowhurst and his friends. They'll be caught one day. Val told her aunt that one of the men at the base had been caught stealing the American supplies and selling them on the black market. He was going to prison. Best place for Ted Butters, said Annie. The following morning, Val arrived at the farm half an hour earlier than usual. Archie was still at the kitchen table, nursing a large mug of tea and reading a farming leaflet. She knocked at the kitchen window and was invited in.
Has something happened?
He asked.
Nothing. Well, something has, I suppose.
Ted Butters knows that Peter Woodhouse is here. Archie raised an eyebrow. He did not seem overly concerned.
How did he work that out?
She told him, stressing that Willie was not entirely responsible for his actions. He understands some things, she said, but he doesn't always work things out the same as you and I do.
So I see, said Archie. But no use crying over spilt milk.
No, she paused. What do you think Ted Butters will do?
Archie shrugged. He might come round here. If he does, I'll tell him the dog has voted with his feet. I'll tell him there'll be no taking him back.
She was concerned that the other farmer might create trouble. Archie nodded.
Yes, there's always that, I suppose. But I'll deal with any trouble he makes. He has a foul temper on him, that man, but I've dealt with the likes of him before.
She was reassured. So we do nothing.
We carry on, said Archie. Isn't that what they're always telling us, the government, that is? Carry on, they say. Well, that's what we'll do.
He swigged the rest of his tea and then rose from the table.
We've got half a field of cabbages to get in while this weather holds, my girl. Let's not waste any time.
They went to work. At 11 in the morning, they stopped for a short break, and that was when they saw Bill Edwards coming up the farm track on his ancient black bicycle. The policeman waved to them and then parked his bike against a hedge at the bottom of the cabbage field. Picking his way around the side of the field, he came to join them.
"Well, Bill," said Archie, "you looking for a German spy or something? Nobody around here, I'm afraid."
The policeman smiled.
"You checked your hayloft recently, Archie. It's a great place for a German spy to hide up."
"I'll do as you say, Bill," said Archie.
The policeman cleared his throat. He was still sweating from the ride up from the village, and now he wiped his brow with a large red handkerchief.
"Actually, Archie," he began, "it's a tricky one. I've had a visit from Ted Butters. You know him?"
"Of course I do," said Archie.
"Not that I'd describe him as a friend."
"There's a lot would say that,"
said the policeman.
"I keep out of these scraps, obviously, but I hear what people are saying, and thinking too sometimes. And I know who's popular and who isn't. Not that I'm saying anything about it, mind."
Archie nodded.
"Of course not. Anyway," continued the policeman, "Ted Butters comes round to see me first thing this morning and lays a complaint that you've stolen his dog. He says it's worth £6, being a highly trained sheepdog."
"Oh, good dog's not cheap," said Archie.
Bill Edwards looked embarrassed.
"You can't turn a blind eye to the taking of a dog worth £6, he said. "That's the same thing as stealing a horse, just as valuable."
"I suppose so," said Archie. "But nobody's stolen that Butter's dog. He mistreated it, by the way. He beat it, something terrible. A dog won't stand for that, you know. A dog will try to get away."
Bill Edwards pursed his lips.
"A dog doesn't run away by itself. Dogs stay. I've had dogs myself."
"Some dogs do," insisted Archie. "It all depends on the dog."
Bill fiddled with the policeman's helmet he was holding.
"You wouldn't happen to have this dog on your farm, would you, Archie? I'm asking you directly, see, as a friend, so to speak."
Archie hesitated, but then he gave his response.
"It's here, Bill, because the poor creature was being beaten to death up at Butter's place. We couldn't stand by."
The policeman's embarrassment deepened.
"A farmer's dog's different, Archie. You know that. It's part of the farm equipment, so to speak. You can't take it off him."
"I'm not disputing that, Bill," said Archie. "But there's the dog to think of here. A dog's not like other bits of property. A dog's different." The policeman shifted his weight from foot to foot.
"Oh, you don't want to make a fuss about this, Archie, but if a complaint's been made..."
He gave the farmer an imploring look.
"Of course, if the dog were to go somewhere else for a while, then I could truthfully inform Butters that there's no dog here. I'll come back officially tomorrow. This is an unofficial visit, you'll understand. And there'll be no dog, and that'll be the end of it, as far as I'm concerned."
Archie smiled. "You're a good man, Bill," he said. "We'll make sure there's no dog for your official visit." They watched him ride down the road back towards the village.
"That's the way a policeman should behave," said Archie.
"There's always a solution, if you're prepared to be flexible."
Chapter 8. If they could manage it, the time Mike and Val had together, precious hours snatched between the claims of flying and working on the farm, was spent away from others. Wartime was a period of constant sharing with people you did not know, in bomb shelters, in overcrowded public transport, in the endless queuing for almost everything. To be alone with another, to talk without fear of being overheard, seemed at times to be an impossible, only dimly remembered luxury, almost an act of selfishness. After completing a spell of intensive duties, he was given 2 days' leave. He wanted to go away, to drive off with her in a car lent by one of the other pilots, but it was a busy time on the farm, and she felt unable to ask for 2 full days off. 1 day at the most, she said, would be all that she could manage. He said that in wartime you had to take what you could get. The weather was fine, and they could take a picnic. He could still get the use of the car, and they could go wherever she suggested. "I know a place," she said. "There's a river and a bank that would be ideal for a picnic. Sometimes people swim there, but most of the time there's nobody." He said,
"I have some
tin peaches."
He laughed.
"Yes."
Tinned peaches had become a private joke, because she had told him about Annie's craving for them, and he had already supplied a few tins for her.
"What's it with you people and tinned peaches?" he asked. "Tinned peaches are just..." He shrugged his shoulders. "Just tinned peaches."
"I know that, but there's something about..."
"Something about tinned peaches?"
She smiled. She loved him so much. She was sure of it now. Love came to you on the coattails of such small things. Conversations about tinned peaches, looks exchanged at odd moments, the way that the other person glanced up at the sky or scratched his head or said something about the weather.
"Yes," she said. "Maybe it's because we could never get them. You really want the things you can't get, don't you?"
He kissed her. They were standing outside the post office, and there were people about, but she did not mind. Some people did not like the way the Americans flirted with the local girls, but most did not feel that way. And if those who did not like it should choose to talk, what difference did it make? People disapproved of the things they had themselves missed. Annie had pointed that out to her once, and she realized that it was quite true. "If somebody shakes their head and tut-tuts," she said, "you can be sure it's because they wanted to do whatever they're shaking their head and tut-tutting over."
"So," he said, "tinned peaches. And what else?"
She thought for a moment.
"Sandwiches. A picnic isn't a picnic without sandwiches."
"What sort?"
She answered without hesitation.
"Oh, ham, I'd say. And egg, and maybe cucumber."
She paused.
"Yes, cucumber. That's what Annie gives the vicar when he calls round. Cucumber sandwiches. The vicar tucks into a whole plate of them and eats the lot, every one of them."
"I suppose it's part of his job," said Mike. "I think that you have to eat things in some jobs. We have a congressman back in Indiana who's really fat. He said something in the newspaper about how it all came from his job, visiting folks' houses and having to eat their cookies and cakes or they won't vote for you. It's tough."
Val smiled vaguely. She was thinking of their picnic.
"I don't think we've got any ham."
"Leave it to me," said Mike.
"We've got plenty of eggs," said Val, brightening. "And cress. We grow that."
"Then that's our picnic fixed," said Mike.
He leaned forward and kissed her again. As he did so, she thought,
"Don't fly ever again. Stay with me. We'll run away together. Anywhere, anywhere. The war can get on with itself. It doesn't need us."
But she knew that was wrong, even as the thought came to her. This was their war, and they had to see it through. He flew a plane, and she dug potatoes and carrots. Two different ways of fighting the same war. They found the place by the river, but only after taking a few wrong turnings and having to reverse down impossibly narrow lanes, bounded by out-of-control hedgerows. With people being too busy growing food, there was little time for the luxury of hedge trimming, and here and there unbridled growth from either side met above a road, making a tunnel, a green womb of dappled light and startled birds. At length, Val saw a road she recognized, and they found the lay-by where the car could be left. From there, a path followed the edge of a field of ripening wheat down towards a copse of willow trees and the river bank. She remembered the spot from when she had last been there, just after the war had started. She had come with three other young women, cycling over from the village, a journey of almost 10 miles. It had been a hot day, and they had swum in the river, just beneath the lip of a weir, allowing the cooling water to cascade over them like a shower. Then they had lain in the sun, waiting for their bedraggled hair to dry, with one of them keeping watch in case any of the boys from the village should arrive. There was a story, and nobody knew if it was true, about how boys would steal the clothes off swimmers and then hide in the bushes to witness the commotion. She pointed to a spot shaded by one of the willows, and he laid down the rug he had brought from the car. They embraced. She said,
"I don't want you to go."
He touched her forehead lightly.
"I don't want to go either, but I can't."
He shrugged. What was the word?
"Desert."
There had been a deserter at the base, a young man from Kentucky who had travelled to London and been picked up by the military police in a bar, drunk and in the company of a woman he had met on the streets of Soho. He had been sent back to the States and to prison. She sighed and took his hand in hers. No, I know you have to do what you're doing, and I wouldn't want to marry a coward. He looked at her and wondered whether people who did not go up in planes, who did not face enemy fighters and flak, knew what that particular terror was like. Of course, you could not allow yourself to think about it, and certainly not to talk about it. You had to behave as if you felt none of it, as if you didn't care what happened, while all the time it was always there within you, a cold, hard knot of fear that settled in your stomach and could make you want to retch. Only retching solved nothing, because the fear would soon return. She sensed his doubt over what she had said. Of course, I wouldn't call people cowards if they simply couldn't take it. I know how difficult it must be. He lay back on the rug, looking up at the sky. I have not met any cowards, he said. Not one. I've met people who have cried their eyes out because of everything, sitting there crying their eyes out because, well, I guess because they don't want to die, or because they're thinking about the guy they shot down, or something like that. I've met them, but I've never met a coward. No, she said. I'm sure you haven't. I shouldn't have said it. No, you can say it, because there is such a thing, and because I can think of times when I've been a coward. She stared at him. She wished she'd never mentioned the word. Can I tell you about it? He asked. She nodded her head. Because, he went on, I've been thinking about this thing a lot recently. I don't know why. He paused. Maybe it's just that when you know that at any moment, he stopped himself. You did not discuss that possibility, especially with your girl. Of course, she knew what the unspoken words would have been. She looked into his eyes. Yes, she began, and then trailed off. Anyway, he continued, I've been thinking of something I did when I was a boy, something I'm ashamed of. She tried to make light of it. Who hasn't done things they're ashamed of? Lots and lots of things when they were young. Who? He shrugged. Maybe no one. Well, there you are. Except I can't get this out of my mind. I say to myself, you were just a kid. It was a long time ago, and I wait for that to work. But it doesn't. At first, she said nothing. She was thinking now of how committing to a joint future brought two pasts together. She realized that she had not given much thought to what marriage meant. How could you think about such things when the world was topsy-turvy with conflict? You could not. But now, she thought, I'm taking on another person's memories, another person's family, another person's life. Love obscured all of that, because if it did not, then nobody would marry at all, and there had to be marriage, didn't there? If people wanted to continue, have children, keep everything going. I shouldn't bother you with all this, he said. There are other things to talk about. She reassured him. No, you should, because I want you to talk to me. We shouldn't have any secrets, he interjected, smiling. Isn't that what they say? You don't have any secrets from the person you're going to marry? She chided him. I'm being serious. He thought for a moment. Okay. Val waited. Somewhere in the distance there was a shout, answered by another, boys playing along the river. A cuckoo calling, a breeze in the leaves of the trees, the vague sound that heat made. There was a kid at school, Mike said. He was called Jimmy Clark. We called him Stan, after Stan Laurel, because he looked a bit like him, and walked like him, too. We laughed at him. Everybody laughed at him. He was, well, sort of uncoordinated, clumsy. You know that sort of kid. Val thought of a girl she had known at school who was always losing things and getting into trouble as a result. She nodded. This guy, this Jimmy Clark, didn't have many friends. In fact, he probably had none. He used to ask people if they would be his friend. He asked me once, I remember. And although people didn't exactly say no, they never really hung around with him. People were kind of embarrassed, if you see what I mean. Children are like that, aren't they? Yes, but this went on all the way through high school. She sighed. I suppose that's the way it goes. He admired me, said Mike. I was on the football team. I guess I found it easy to make friends.
He looked up to you?
Yes, I think so. Mike paused. He asked me to go to his place and see this model railway set up his dad had made. His father was one of these railway enthusiasts who collect model trains, engines, track, the lot. They make a big thing of it. And Mr. Clark had made this whole system, it seemed. Tunnels, the works.
You saw it?
Mike shook his head. No. I said I was too busy because... He faltered before continuing. I didn't want people to think that I was friendly with Jimmy Clark, who was a real loser who still played with trains. She looked at him and saw pain in his eyes, but it was such a little thing, she thought, such a little thing. And her heart went out to him that he should fret over a small unkindness of childhood. He should not. No, she was proud that he should care about something that all of us must have done at some time or other, because we were young and thoughtless. You shouldn't blame yourself for that, she said. It wasn't such a big thing.
I haven't told you what happened.
She caught her breath. I heard that he enlisted. After I joined the Air Force, I heard that Jimmy Clark enlisted in the Army. He was put into the Dental Corps. He helped the dentist, I suppose, you know, with the instruments and the mouthwash and so on. Val said she thought that must have been important. You always need dentists, even when there's a war going on.
Of course, agreed Mike. Of course it was important. Toothache's toothache. We've got a dentist at the base.
So that's what happened to him?
Mike looked away.
Until he was killed, yes. She closed her eyes. It was the way wartime stories ended. He was somewhere in the Pacific. I heard from my aunt, who reads everything in the local paper and sends me cuttings. She sent me the report. There was a picture of Jimmy, and the article just said that he'd been killed on active duty. There was a picture of his mom and dad, too. The report quoted them. They said how proud they were of their son. Then the paper said that he would be much missed by his friends.
Val reached out to take his hand.
Oh, Mike, she whispered. Missed by his friends.
Me?
He turned back to face her. You see how I feel.
Yes, of course I do. But you shouldn't dwell on this. You didn't know.
Didn't know that he was going to go off and get himself killed? In the Dental Corps? No, of course I didn't. But I don't think that made me feel any better. I could have been his friend. I could have gone to his place to see that damn rail track. I could have done something. But I didn't.
But it's the war that makes everything, well, rather worse. It's not you, Mike. It's the war.
He shook his head. It makes me think that you should never not say what you need to say.
No.
So, I love you, Val. I love you so much. She made an effort at cheerfulness.
What will our house be like? Our house in Muncie, Indiana?
He smiled.
Really neat. With a garden?
Yes, a garden, trees, flowers in the summer.
Anything you like.
And a car?
He laughed.
Of course. I'll teach you how to drive. Our roads are much straighter than yours. Wider, too.
So I won't hit anything.
Not if you drive straight. They ate their sandwiches. They walked along the riverbank to where the boys they had heard earlier on were swimming. They had a dog in the water with them, and the dog was fetching sticks.
Could we take a dog with us to America? She asked.
He looked doubtful. I don't think so. I don't think you can take a dog. He looked at her fondly.
You shouldn't worry too much about dogs. Dogs have their own lives, you know.
She knew that.
But their lives get all tangled up with ours, she said.
He agreed. It's what they want, I think.
Even in our wars?
He had not thought about that. But she was right, he decided. They turned back. One of the boys shouted from the water,
Good luck, mister! Kill the Germans, mister!
They're just boys, said Val.
Chapter 9 When Bill Edwards had gone, Archie said to Val, "Can you take that dog back to your aunt's place, just for the time being? A week or two, maybe a bit longer?" Val thought about this. Annie had a kind heart, but her situation was awkward. Everybody went to the post office from time to time, including Ted Butters. Ted's cousin, Alice, lived a couple of houses away. She and Ted were on good terms, and she would probably recognize the dog easily enough. They could not risk that now that Bill Edwards was involved. "It would be better for him to go somewhere else," she said. "You know how it is in the village. People talk. Even in wartime, they talk." Archie understood. "You're right. He must go somewhere else." He looked at her inquiringly. "Any ideas?" Suddenly it came to her. "Yes," she said. "Mike will take him." "Your fellow?" "My fiancé now. Yes, he likes dogs. And he said that somebody at the base had a dog, but it ran away." Archie looked unconvinced. "An Air Force base is no place for a dog. All that noise, all that coming and going." "It won't be for long," said Val. "And think of the attention he'll get. And the food." Archie had to admit the food would be better. "They have steaks down there," he said. "They have steaks the size of which you wouldn't dream of. A dog could get the trimmings and do very well out of them." Val smiled. "He'd be well fed. The Americans look after their own." Archie shrugged. "If you'll take him, that's the answer." He paused. "We could drive him there in the van. I've got a drop of petrol." They went out into the yard. Peter Woodhouse was in his kennel, tied to the wire run that allowed him a certain measure of freedom. He leapt up at Val and licked her hands and arms enthusiastically, reaching her face and covering it with slobbering kisses. "He knows," she said. "He knows that we're planning something for him." They drove to the base, taking with them the delivery of eggs that would get them past the guard. Val was known there now, not because of the engagement, which was unofficial, but as a supplier of eggs. Sergeant Lizovsky had told the guardroom that she could come and go as she pleased, and she had never encountered any difficulty in getting past the front gate. Now, on this visit, there were a few more questions as Archie was asked who he was, but they were soon waved through. Because Val did not know whether Mike would be there, she spoke to Sergeant Lizovsky.
"The lieutenant's on a mission," he said. "Just left."
She explained about Peter Woodhouse without mentioning the real reason why refuge was needed.
"We can't look after him right now," she said. "I wondered if Mike could take him."
Sergeant Lizovsky looked down at the dog.
"I love dogs. We had wiener dogs back in Pittsburgh, three of them. They're great dogs, small bodies, big hearts."
"This is a sheepdog," said Val. "They're not like, what did you call them?"
"Wiener dogs. You call them sausage dogs over here," said Sergeant Lizovsky. "They're German, but they're not Nazis." Archie laughed. "Dogs don't know about these things," he said.
Sergeant Lizovsky looked momentarily surprised.
"I guess they don't."
He bent down to pat Peter Woodhouse.
"I can take care of this dog, even if the lieutenant doesn't want him. Maybe we can look after him together."
"I'd like that," said Val.
Sergeant Lizovsky took the lead they had attached to Peter Woodhouse's collar. The dog looked up at him, and then at Val and Archie. He was clearly confused. Val saw that, and her face fell.
"They know when we're abandoning them," she said. "They can tell."
"He's not being abandoned," said Archie. "I would never abandon a dog."
"No," said Val. "I'm sorry. We're handing him over temporarily."
"Temporarily," agreed Sergeant Lizovsky. "Everything's temporary these days, isn't it? Life itself, temporary."
It was 10 days before she saw Mike again. She had a message, though, left with her aunt at the post office, delivered from the base. It was a short note to tell her that Peter Woodhouse was doing fine. "They call him Woody here," he wrote. "The base commander has taken a shine to him and says he can be on pay and rations as a mascot. So Uncle Sam is paying for him now. One of the men has gotten hold of a collar from somewhere. A swell new collar with his name burned into the leather. It suits him just fine." And then he ended with the private fondness that made her heart skip. She loved this man. It was as simple as that. This was a good, kind man who would take on somebody else's dog and was so gentle in everything he did. A gentle boy in the middle of the great machinery of war. She told Archie about the note, and he seemed pleased. Bill Edwards had called round at the farmhouse on his official visit while Val had been in one of the fields. She had not seen him, but Archie told her how Bill had made much of looking around the barn and noting things down in that notebook of his. "He showed me what he had written," he said. "He wrote, 'Inspected barn, no dog of the description. Inspected farmyard, no dog of the description.'" Archie laughed. I said to him, "Bill, this is a bit of play-acting, ain't it?" And he shook his head and said, "Archie, I never told any lies in my whole police career, and I'm not going to start now. I can show that Ted Butters my notebook and tell him face-to-face that his dog was not at your farm. I can tell him I looked, and all of that will be God's truth, every word of it." Val smiled. "It's better not to lie. And you don't want policemen who lie, do you?" "If we have that," said Archie, "if we have lying policemen and all that, then what's the point of this war, I ask you?" She looked at him. She was thinking of Mike and of what he was doing. Why was he here? He was risking his life every day, or however often it was that he went on those missions, because he had been told to do it. It was a long way from Muncie, Indiana, but he had come because it was his duty. Archie had more to say. "I wonder if they'll take Peter Woodhouse up in their planes. He said he was going to be a mascot. They won't take him with them, will they, for good luck?" Val said she thought this unlikely. "A plane is no place for a dog. Dogs don't like planes." This tickled Archie. "Dogs don't like planes? Who told you that, young Val? You ever put a dog in a plane?" She blushed. "Stands to reason, doesn't it? Dogs don't like loud noises." Archie disagreed. "Peter Woodhouse hopped up smartly enough on Henry Field's tractor. Remember, when he brought it round, Peter was up there like a rat up a drainpipe. He didn't mind the noise, wanted to be part of what was going on." "Tractors and planes are different," said Val. "I don't think dogs like planes. I just think that. I've got no proof." Mike took her to the local pub when he had his next pass. "We've been busy," he said. "Your boys have been pounding the Germans, and we've been taking pictures of it all." He shook his head. "They won't be able to take much more of this now that we've landed in France. We'll just push on and on until we get to Berlin." "We want it to end," she said. "So does everybody. Germans, too, I imagine. They're people, after all. But Hitler's their fault." "Sure, he's their fault." He was silent for a few moments. Then he said, "Woody is doing just fine. When do you want him back?" She had not thought about this, but she explained their concern about Ted Butters. "Someone might tell him again," she said. "We probably need to leave it a little while yet." Mike seemed pleased. "He fits in well. He obeys orders, you see. Some dogs wouldn't. Sergeant Blazovsky had those little Dachshunds back in Pittsburgh."
"He told us."
"Yes, well, he says that his dogs would never obey orders. He said they'd be court-martialed pretty quickly." She moved her knees so that it was touching his under the table. There were fewer opportunities for physical closeness than they would have liked. A war was a public time. Private moments were difficult, although people took what chances they could. Mike took a sip from his glass. He had forced himself to drink the warm beer that had so surprised him at the beginning. Now he liked it. "He came with us last time," he said. "You know that? He came in the plane."
She was wide-eyed. "Over there? Over wherever it is you go?"
He nodded. "He whined and whined, and the major eventually said, 'Okay, you guys can take him with you.' That was all, and he was great in the plane. We took an old flying jacket for him to lie on, and he lay there all through the mission. I held him when we made it back to the base so that he wouldn't get thrown around if it was a rough landing."
"As your mascot?"
"Yeah, a mascot, for good luck."
She asked him whether they would take him again. He replied that they would.
"Once you start doing something for good luck, you can't stop it just like that. That's bad luck, so you keep on doing it."
She told Archie the next day. They're taking Peter Woodhouse up in their planes. He's flying with them.
Archie did not express surprise. They're quite the boys, he said. All those Air Force people are. Ours, theirs, they're all the same.
Chapter 10 The Colonel sent his clerk to fetch Mike from the officer's mess. It was a summons that everybody dreaded. Bad news from home was usually delivered by the Colonel himself, who did not believe in delegating unpleasant duties to subordinates. And he did it well, because he was sympathetic. Some said the most sympathetic colonel in the U.S. Air Force. That was not the same thing as being soft, they said. He could be as tough as the situation demanded, but he felt for his men, and he understood how difficult this war was for so many of them. Farm boys who should have been driving tractors rather than flying planes and being killed in Europe. Mike saluted and waited for the worst.
I haven't called you in for bad news, the colonel said quickly. Nothing like that.
Mike relaxed. He grinned.
That's a relief, sir. The colonel indicated for him to sit down. Nor is there any problem with your flying. Nothing but good reports.
I do my best, sir. The colonel looked past him, over his shoulder, to where the flag fluttered in the afternoon breeze. A wireless was playing somewhere, and then it was switched off.
This mascot you guys have taken on, what's his name again?
Mike smiled.
Peter Woodhouse, sir. He had that name when we took him. We're looking after him for my girl, but he's somehow stayed on.
No objection to that, said the colonel. Nice dog. I had setters back in Maine. Irish setters. You know those dogs?
I've seen them, sir. The colonel looked back into the room.
My daddy swore by them. He said you couldn't get a smarter dog in this world than an Irish setter. He bred them, you know, and won all the prizes at the dog shows. When he died, I took over his dogs. Four of them. One very old one, who never got over his death, pined, you see, pined away to nothing. Had to shoot him eventually because he was just skin and bone, and it hurt him too much to walk. A great dog, though.
Mike nodded. My grandfather had a coon dog on his farm. Nothing special. He was the greediest dog you ever met. The colonel laughed.
Dogs are always hungry. You show me a dog that's not hungry, and I'll tell you you've got yourself a cat by mistake.
Mike looked at his hands. The colonel had not invited him into his office to talk about the merits of different breeds of dogs.
This dog of yours, I know he's been up in the plains.
He looked at Mike over the top of his rimless spectacles, but he was smiling as he spoke.
Don't ever think I don't know what's going on.
Mike nodded. I'd never say that, sir. The colonel sat back in his chair.
He likes it?
He seems to, sir. He likes being with us. You know how dogs like going in cars and trucks. It's like that. He thinks it's a truck, I guess.
The colonel laughed. Well, I suppose it feels the same. He paused. And he doesn't get in the way?
Never, sir. Just lies there.
He tries to stand up when we land, but soon lies down again.
The colonel laughed again.
All right. It's going to have to stop, though. You won't have heard, but I'm being sent down to London for 2 months. My job here is going to be done by Colonel Harold Mortensen. He's not the easiest man in the Air Force, and, well, I'm just making sure that everything is regular before I leave. I don't want him telling anybody that I let people get away with things.
Mike said that he understood.
So, after next Monday, this, what's his name again?
Peter Woodhouse.
This Peter Woodhouse is grounded.
Mike inclined his head in acceptance. But we can keep him here on the base? The colonel made an expansive gesture.
Sure, you can do that, and he can carry on flying until Monday.
If he wants. Mike grinned. I think he probably will want to, he said.
The colonel looked at his watch. That's it, Rogers. Leave the door open on your way out. This heat, we're not used to it over here.
Mike passed on the news to his crew and to Sergeant Lazowski, who had taken on responsibility for feeding Peter Woodhouse. They were to fly a mission the next morning, leaving shortly after 5, and Mike had the dog's rug brought over to his room so that he could sleep there that night rather than in his kennel behind the cookhouse. It was raining in the morning, but the cloud had lifted by the time they took off, and the sun was already bright on the rooftops of the village when Mike looked down on it. He saw the post office, and he thought of Val, wondering whether he should have asked her to be outside, looking up as he flew over her. He had never done that before, and thought that he probably never would. It would be bad luck to do that. Doing anything out of the ordinary could tempt Providence when the odds were stacked so dangerously against you. England was a carpet of green beneath them. He saw Cambridge, a smudge of grey lanced by a silver strip. The morning sun was on the river, sending up a shard of light. Then came the blue expanse of the North Sea, and beyond that, the coast of the Netherlands, with its covering of thin mist. Once they were above that, it was mostly water down below, dikes and polders confusing the transition between the sea and the land behind the sea. His navigator was usually accurate. He knew by dead reckoning where they were and how long it would take them to get to where they wanted to be. But he could also find railway lines and church spires and roads just by looking, reading the landscape below as easily as if it were a map. He now said, "Half an hour and we'll be there." They were to photograph Arnhem, which was heavily defended by the occupying Germans. Their pictures would show the position of fortifications and their strength. They had to go over their target quickly, hoping that the anti-aircraft guns would not spot a single plane coming from an unexpected quarter. Conditions were right. A cloudless sky stretched off to the east, while the land below was bathed in light. Mike looked up, as he often did before the final approach. He said a prayer, the words a vague jumble of propitiation. There was God, and sorry, and return. There was Val, and mother, and home. On the deck, Peter Woodhouse was half asleep, half awake. The navigator leaned down and stroked his head, and Peter Woodhouse looked up, licked his hand. Mike half turned to see this, and smiled. The navigator slipped his fingers under the collar that they had put on the dog to check that it was not too tight. He believed that dogs swelled up at altitude, and that could make the collar uncomfortable. It needed no adjustment. He looked at the inscription that he had painstakingly burned into the leather with a heated nail, the dots marking up the words, "Peter Woodhouse, U.S. Air Force, Dog, First Class," and giving the name of their base. He was proud of that. It was Peter's identity disc, the token of his membership and service. Mike pointed to something off their wing. Small puffs of smoke appearing in the sky before dissipating quickly, like the birth and rapid death of tiny clouds. Chapter 11. Archie explained to Val that there were always more potatoes than one imagined, and that you had to dig deep enough to find them. "You probably know that," he said. "Everyone knows about potatoes." She did. Annie grew potatoes in the post office garden at the back of the house, where once there had been flowers, vegetables now grew. She had taken out the roses she loved so much and turned some of the ground over to leeks and potatoes and the Jerusalem artichokes that were now colonizing most of the rest. The grocer bought the surplus of those or exchanged them for beans, of which there sometimes seemed to be too many. It was hot work. Val had found a hat, a battered straw hat that belonged to Annie but had not been worn for years. It provided some protection, but she felt the rays of the August sun beating down on her back and shoulders. Mike liked her complexion. He said it was paler and softer than that of most girls back home, and he would not want her to burn. She looked about her. A small clump of alders along the edge of the field would give some shade, and she could take her break there. She was thinking of him. It was only 10 days ago that they had become physically intimate. She had thought of that moment again and again, and was in awe of its significance. It had changed everything for her. She had given herself to him. She was his. Nothing would ever be the same again. Nothing. Annie had sensed it. She had said, "Be careful. That's all I'm going to say to you. Be careful." Val had looked away, avoiding her aunt's gaze, but then had turned to her, and Annie had put her arms around her and said, "He's made his promise to you, it's all right. It's different for engaged couples, which is what you are. It's allowed, especially in wartime." especially in wartime. She knew what that meant, and it made her heart a cold stone within her. The rules were different in wartime because people knew that they could lose each other so easily. Everyone was in harm's way, not just